Today is Tuesday, August 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What's next for Lebanon after its government stepped down?
The gigantic explosion left more than 150 dead, 5,000 injured, and as many as a quarter of a million homes destroyed.
Plus, clashes continued in Belarus.
People took to the street in the capital, Minsk, for a second night after the opposition accused President Alexander Lukashenko on rigging his re-election.
And Greece calls for an emergency EU meeting over rising tensions with Turkey. We'll have those stories and more next. The resignation of Lebanon's government comes as many people fear that hundreds of millions of dollars in international aid could end up in the pockets of the same politicians they hold responsible for the catastrophic explosion in Beirut last week. Anchan Vora starts us off.
Thousands of protesters returned to downtown Beirut, the epicenter of protests which first began in October, and said they have had enough. Some called not only for the removal of the political class, but demanded the politicians be hanged. Many Lebanese accused the leadership of ignoring the warnings to dispose of the thousands of tons of ammonium nitrate that caused the explosion. The gigantic explosion left more than 150 dead, 5,000 injured, and as many as a quarter of a million homes destroyed. Neda Hakim volunteered to clean the streets. She tied a noose to her broom.
This is the broom that I've been using to clean up the houses and the streets of the people who lost everything. And the noose is for the government that has killed us all, not just the people who died, but all of us, everyone living in Lebanon.
Shortly after Saturday's demonstration began, security forces fired tear gas at protesters who tried to break the cordon around the parliament building. The protesters succeeded in storming the foreign ministry to vent their anger against the establishment. As the evening progressed, uniformed men beat some of the protesters and cleared them from the streets. Undeterred, the protesters were back the next day. The protesters warned an international panel to investigate the explosion, saying they have no trust in their government. 21-year-old Izar Lahoud came out with his friends. He said he wants politicians dead or thrown out of the country.
They are not thinking about us. They are thinking about their own duties and their self, how to make money. But we are dying here. No politician cares.
The international community is pledging millions in aid. But in a country where graft and mismanagement had already sparked months of unrest before the disaster, there is fear that the money may end up in the pockets of corrupt politicians. Anshul Vora for VOA News, Beirut.
So what's next for the country and its people? Now, to help with that question, I spoke with Emily Hawthorne, Middle East and North Africa analyst for Stratfor, a RAIN company.
This really is the key question. We are at a precipice for Lebanon. The question is, does the government and the political structure in Lebanon return to business as usual, and we see the same kind of sectarian entrenchment and corruption that caused a lot of these protests that began before the port explosion? Or do we actually see this as a bit of a Chernobyl moment, something that forces a change in the regime and leads to new structural reforms? And I don't think anyone can answer that question right now.
Trying to figure out what's next for the country is difficult, but it's not alone in the region. So how is the economic crisis compounded with this humanitarian crisis in Beirut going to affect the region?
Yeah, Lebanon is dealing with a serious currency crisis as well as a debt crisis. Its banks are under pressure, but really the people suffering are those who put their money into the banks for years and years and years. And Lebanon's financial sector used to be really a banking haven, a banking headquarters for the whole Middle East region. That hasn't been the case in the last several years as the banking sector has come under strain. But it is fair to say that if you do see a banking sector collapse in Lebanon, which is a possibility right now with the severity of the financial crisis, that will have a ripple effect in the broader region. Lebanon is an important place in the Arab world, so a collapse there is not going to just be contained within its borders.
Is this enough to actually instill long-time change in the country?
To many protesters, to many regular Lebanese people, the resignations matter, but they simply are not enough, because without actual electoral or structural government reform, you're just going to see a revolving door of the same personalities going back into the same kinds of positions. So what many Lebanese want is an actual change to how the system is run, to how elections are held.
How do you get there?
You know, I think right now is a critical moment. If enough Lebanese from enough different sects and minorities and all the groups in this diverse country come together and continue demanding actual change from the government, and if external actors, the IMF, France, the United States, if external countries sort of condition their financial aid accordingly, only if there's going to be reforms, then I do think that we're at a place where you could see some of those reforms take place.
That was Emily Hawthorne, a Middle East and North Africa analyst with the RAIN company Stratfor. The arrest of Apple Daily newspaper owner Jimmy Lai in Hong Kong garnered international condemnation. Human Rights Watch called Lai's and the others that were arrested Monday under the national security law an attempt to dismantle Hong Kong's civil society. The pro-democracy newspaper Apple Daily responded with defiance on Tuesday, and Reuters' Ryan Brooks takes it from here.
Hot off the presses, more than half a million copies of Hong Kong newspaper Apple Daily were printed with a message of defiance Tuesday after the arrest of owner Jimmy Lai. The day's edition ran with the headline, "Apple Daily Must Fight On," plastered on the front page above an image of Lai in handcuffs. He was taken into detention the day before after police raided the pro-democracy tabloid's offices. It was the highest-profile arrest made yet under a national security law imposed by Beijing. Readers responded by lining up at newsstands across the city in the early hours of the morning, itching to get their hands on a copy. Some vendors even told Reuters they sold out of the newspaper during the a.m. rush hour. Newsstand owner Judy Doe.
Anytime I check the news yesterday makes every youngster want to read Apple Daily. They must read it. Some who don't usually buy newspapers said that they had to buy it.
Lai is one of Hong Kong's most prominent democracy activists and a staunch critic of Communist Party rule in Beijing. Police detained him for suspected collusion with foreign forces, and 200 officers searched the Apple Daily's offices and collected boxes of evidence. He was one of 10 people they arrested on Monday, including other Apple Daily executives and 23-year-old Agnes Chow. Chow was one of the former leaders of young activist Joshua Wong's Demasisto group, which disbanded before the new law came into force. Monday's arrests left 45-year-old Kim Yao concerned over the city's freedoms under the security law.
What the police did yesterday brutally interfered with the freedom of press. All Hong Kongers with a conscience have to support Hong Kong today and support Apple Daily.
International reaction to Lai's arrest came within hours. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Monday called Lai a, quote, patriot who wanted good things for the people of Hong Kong. Britain claimed the arrest was further evidence that the security law was, quote, pretext to silence opposition. China's embassy in Britain hit back, urging London to stop, quote, using freedom of the press as an excuse to discredit the national security law. Meanwhile, in mainland China, the Beijing-backed China Daily wrote in an editorial that Lai's arrest showed, quote, the cost of dancing with the enemy. In the past, Beijing has labeled Lai a traitor.
Ryan Brooks reports for Reuters News. And coming up later,
defense ministry officials deny that reservists had been called up overnight as a result of the brewing crisis. Still, the same sources tell VOA that Greece's entire military apparatus is on red alert.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A
Saturn's 82 moons, Titan, its largest, has been of specific interest to scientists. Titan is the only moon in the solar system to have its own thick atmosphere. And according to NASA, the giant moon is the only other object in our grouping of planets to have a liquid cycle, from rain to flowing liquid on its surface to evaporating back into the sky to begin another cycle. Titan, like Earth's moon and others, is also widening its orbit and pulling away from its planet due to the give-and-take gravitational energy between planet and moon. Scientists calculated that our moon is drifting away at 3.8 centimeters per year. Digging through data gathered by NASA's 13-year Cassini mission, scientists were surprised to learn that Titan is pulling away from Saturn at 11 centimeters per year, which is faster than thought. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. According to the Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker, the world has passed the 20 million mark for confirmed cases and nearly 750,000 deaths. New Zealand confirmed new cases of locally acquired COVID-19 after going for 102 days without any domestic transmission. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced that Auckland will move to alert level 3 restrictions starting at noon on Wednesday for 3 days, and that the rest of the country will move to alert level 2 restrictions. Across Africa and around the world, the pandemic has disrupted the supply of antiretroviral drugs to many of the more than 24 million people who take them, endangering their lives. A study by UNAIDS shows that a 6-month disruption of antiretroviral therapy in sub-Saharan Africa alone could lead to 500,000 additional AIDS-related deaths. Russian President Vladimir Putin says a COVID-19 vaccine developed in that country is ready for use, and one of his daughters has already been inoculated. Scientists at home and abroad, however, are warning that the rush to start using the vaccine before months of phase 3 trials involving thousands of people could backfire. Senior government officials in the Australian state of Victoria are appearing at a parliamentary inquiry into the response to the COVID-19 crisis. Premier Daniel Andrews and other colleagues are expected to face questions about security breaches in the hotel quarantine system for travelers returning from overseas. Phil Mercer reports.
Australia has equaled its deadliest day of the coronavirus pandemic so far. 19 people in the state of Victoria have died in the past 24 hours, and 331 new infections have been reported. The city of Melbourne is in lockdown until mid-September, and a nighttime curfew is in place. Its streets are almost deserted, as millions of people are forced to stay at home. Only essential businesses can stay open. 19 deaths were recorded in Victoria in the past 24 hours, equaling Australia's deadliest day so far. But with daily new infections near a 2-week low, there is hope that the tide may be turning. Dr. Nick Coatsworth is Australia's Deputy Chief Medical Officer.
This is about Victorians, particularly those under Stage 4 restrictions, but also those under Stage 3 restrictions, getting reward for their efforts. And when we do see it, I think we will all be very happy to see that curve inflect downwards again.
There are claims that infected passengers returning from overseas have been responsible for the second surge of infections in Victoria. Foreign nationals are banned from Australia, but citizens and permanent residents can return home. They face a mandatory 14-day period in hotel isolation. State Premier Daniel Andrews is due to face a committee of lawmakers about security flaws that allowed passengers who tested positive for COVID-19 to spread the virus into the community. A separate judicial inquiry into the hotel quarantine system has heard that security flaws were responsible for Victoria's recent wave of infections. The psychological impact of the pandemic in Victoria is also emerging. The number of patients seeking mental health treatment in hospitals has increased sharply. The state's health minister is Martin Foley.
For young people under 18, we've seen a 33% increase in presentations for people with self-harm in emergency departments.
Dozens of people have been fined for ignoring the curfew in Melbourne and refusing to wear a mask. Victoria is at the centre of Australia's COVID-19 crisis. Neighbouring New South Wales has Tuesday recorded 22 new infections, its highest daily number in almost 4 months, as a cluster linked to a school in Sydney continues to rise. The disease appears to be under control in other Australian states and territories. For VOA News, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Greece's armed forces are on emergency alert following Turkey's decision to send a vessel to explore potential drilling sites off the coast of two Greek islands in the southeast Aegean Sea. Athens is now calling for an emergency European Union meeting to discuss the issue. The escalation comes after Greece and Egypt signed a maritime deal blocking Turkish access to the eastern Mediterranean. That move has angered Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, leading him to flex his country's muscle in a long-running territorial tussle. Anthony Kurosawa reports from Athens.
Defense Ministry officials denied that reservists had been called up overnight as a result of the brewing crisis. Still, the same sources tell VOA that Greece's entire military apparatus is on red alert, monitoring Turkey's movements after the neighboring state launched naval drills east and south of the islands of Rhodes and Kastellorizo in the southeast Aegean Sea over the weekend. The drills include live fire, and most worrying for Greece, Ankara on Monday also sent out the vessel Oruç Reis to survey the continental shelf in an area in the eastern Mediterranean, which both Greece and Turkey consider their own. While both NATO allies, the two neighboring states, have been challenging each other's air and sea rights in the region for decades. The two countries came to the brink of war more than 20 years ago. Just last month, German Chancellor Angela Merkel weighed in on a fresh territorial tussle between the two, convincing President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to back off from sending the Oruç Reis on a similar expedition in the same region. Both sides agreed to a moratorium, promising to refrain from any hostile action until sitting down at a negotiating table later this month to try and sort out differences. But in the past week, Greece has angered Turkey with what Ankara has billed a breach of that moratorium, a maritime agreement that Athens secretly clinched with Egypt, limiting Ankara's influence and energy designs in the region. As a result, Erdogan ordered out the Oruç Reis, sending it on its initial expedition, escorted by Turkish battleships, which Ankara has said it will use if Greece makes any attempt to block the vessel from its course. On Monday, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis chaired an urgent meeting of his National Security Council. A terse announcement issued after the hour-long meeting said officials had assessed the situation and reviewed Greece's response to any Turkish provocation, as they put it. Since then, Mitsotakis has also briefed leading European officials, and he is due to speak to the Secretary General of NATO, insisting, as his advisers tell VOA, that the US-led military alliance weigh in against Turkey. Foreign Minister Nikos Dendias, meantime, says Greece remains ready to sit down and talk with Turkey. We understand that Turkey has called off the talks, but I'm surprised it has done so, Dendias says. Maybe it is a result of some inexplicable rage, he said. We can only hope it comes back to its senses, Dendias said. The stakes are high, and Greece has warned it will use force to block any Turkish encroachment of its sea and land rights. Experts like Kostadinos Filis expect the crisis to escalate before it eases to any show of rapprochement. I expect the tension to grow in the coming days, but ultimately the fate of the feeble Turkish economy will weigh in on any final decision Erdogan will take, Fili says. If he feels Europeans are serious about their threats to retaliate, then he will probably think twice about making any risky moves. Then again, Fili says, Erdogan is extremely unpredictable, and if he feels he is cornered, he may ultimately go for a daring move to cater to his domestic audience alone. EU leaders have already threatened Turkey with economic sanctions. Antika Rasava for VOA News, Athens.
Protests continued in Belarus Monday night, and Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
At least one person died as bloody clashes in Belarus erupted between police and protesters on Monday. People took to the street in the capital, Minsk, for a second night after the opposition accused President Alexander Lukashenko on rigging his re-election. Protesters threw Molotov cocktails and police returned fire with a barrage of tear gas and rubber bullets before dispersing crowds with batons. The government said one man died as he tried to throw an unidentified explosive device which blew up in his hand. A chorus of criticism from Western leaders followed Lukashenko's win over former English teacher Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who led the biggest challenge to Lukashenko's iron grip for more than a quarter of a century. He won 80% of the vote in Sunday's election, while Tikhanovskaya received just under 10%. Germany has called for the European Union to discuss sanctions on Belarus, and neighbouring Poland has called for a special EU summit on the former Soviet country. Foreign observers have not judged an election to be free and fair in Belarus since 1995. Meanwhile, Russia congratulated Lukashenko on his win. Events in Belarus are being closely watched in Moscow, whose oil runs through the country and who sees it as a buffer against NATO. The West is watching too. It's trying to lure Minsk away from Moscow. While Lukashenko has previously rejected Putin's overtures as an assault on Belarusian independence, he has also repeated allegations of shadowy foreign forces manipulating protesters he calls sheep to topple him, and warned, quote, there will be no revolution.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Congress has generously put forward a tremendous supplemental appropriation to deal with COVID in the Middle East region, said Michael Harvey, USAID Assistant Administrator for the Middle East, in a recent interview. Between USAID and the State Department, the United States has contributed over $205 million to the COVID-19 response in the Middle East, part of the more than $1.5 billion the U.S. has committed to date to fight the pandemic worldwide. These funds are specifically aimed to help governments, international organizations, and non-governmental organizations improve public health education, protect healthcare facilities, and increase laboratory, disease surveillance, and rapid response capacity. Assistant Administrator Harvey said that in the Middle East, the funds to fight COVID-19 have reached pretty much every country across the region. Mr. Harvey emphasized that while countries in the region are under tremendous stress because of conflicts in Libya, Yemen, Iraq, and Syria, their own health systems actually performed very, very well in response to the pandemic.
And we are extremely proud of that because we have invested so heavily in building the capacity of those healthcare systems. And they have done well. Their political leadership also managed it with a seriousness that we have seen in few other regions. The economic cost of the shutdown is now what we are really worrying about. How do we get the V recovery to rapidly get economic growth back up?
Assistant Administrator Harvey noted that one country in the Middle East refused the U.S. offer to help when the novel coronavirus started its deadly spread.
Iran declined. It is tragic and heartbreaking how hard the Iranian people were hit by COVID. This is a country with a lot of multi-generational households, and what we're learning around the world is that multi-generational households are particularly hard hit. So we will continue to watch, and we will continue to stand ready to help.
The U.S. government has allocated $20.5 billion to benefit the global COVID-19 response and is determined to remain a leader in the worldwide effort against the disease. The United States, said Assistant Administrator Harvey, has always helped when people are in need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.